Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Robert Kleinhens. He's the chief economist of the Kaiser Center for Economic Research, which conducts research in regional, state, and national economies. Dr. Kleinhens has a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan, a master's and doctorate from USC, all in economics. Prior to joining LAEDC, he served as deputy chief economist at the California Association of Realtors and taught economics for over 15 years, most recently at California State University Fullerton. Robert, we welcome you to our show.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today, Bruce.
Well, look forward to it. We've known each other for some time, so this will actually be fun. Your new job description at the Kaiser Center. What will you be up to?
Well, the Kaiser Center is within the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation, or LAEDC, which, among other things, is interested in promoting the local economy, doing what it can do to help local businesses to streamline permitting processes, trying to promote a long-run vision of where the region is headed in terms of the economy and related issues. And so the Kaiser Center's economic research function is sort of in support of that. We do commentary on what's happening in the economy, what's happening with key sectors in the economy, and then we also produce forecasts. We actually have a forecast event on February the 15th in downtown LA that will be taking place.
Fantastic. And that'll be releasing another one of the reports and the other reports twice a year?
Correct. We have an annual forecast that comes out at the beginning of the year in February, and then a mid-year forecast update that typically is released in July.
Okay. And I think that's the one that I took a serious look at last night. And I must say, one of the things that impressed me about it, it wasn't really in the least bit promotional. It was very informational and seemed to be quite candid if it had to be negative.
Well, I think that's one of the things that has given rise to the reputation that the Kaiser Center and the LAEDC have established over time. It's really maintained its objectivity when looking at issues pertaining to regional economy, and so it certainly, in my view, it has a lot of credibility. It did before I came on board, and so I certainly expect to continue in that vein.
I think that's an asset for the community to have that kind of a document, because when it becomes promotional and becomes inaccurate, it doesn't help anybody map out a proper business plan.
Oh, absolutely. And we're certainly at a key point here. I think 2012 is a pivotal year where potentially we can see the local economic situation and the national situation accelerate if the right things fall into place. So, you know, you got to have an objective view on things so that as business people can make smart decisions about their future and the future for their businesses.
When you're dealing with the local economy, even one as large as Southern California and Los Angeles, how affected are we by state and federal level decisions?
Well, the most obvious impact that we have seen over the last couple of years is that the budget problems that have popped up at the state and, of course, have filtered down to the local level have given rise to real job losses in the public sector. And so the private sector is adding jobs, and they're much needed jobs. As we all know, we've got unemployment rates that continue to be stubbornly high. The economy and the labor market have both been very slow in recovering from this most recent recession. So anything that detracts from growth is problematic in my view. And unfortunately, one of the very weak segments of the labor market over the last couple of years has been public sector or government, the government labor numbers. So they have been declining even as the private sector has taken off. So that certainly is one constraint that we have to deal with in the immediate term. I think the longer term issue that we need to bear in mind is that the state and county government agencies are oftentimes responsible for so much infrastructure that we rely upon, both physical infrastructure and, quite importantly, the education of our young people. And both of these are things that concern me as we look at the longer time frame and the role that government plays here.
You know, you bring up education. It's interesting. Has education needs started to shift? One of the things I read that was very interesting to me was the manufacturing sector. And it's not something we think about being a major player, and yet it really is. But there's shifts going on. And I guess my question as far as the education is, you go through high school, through college, do you emerge as a useful participant in the manufacturing sector in any of that training to where you could take on one of these high-tech manufacturing jobs and function?
I suppose if I'm going to respond to that, I'm going to do so by kind of putting in a plug for people who are able to get college degrees, because I think it's safe to say that the jobs that those people are being will be taking on through the course of their career are jobs that we know nothing about right now. So the most important thing that I think one gets from a college education in particular is learning how to think and to adapt to what is a changing workplace environment and really, you know, dramatic changes that take place both in the consumer side of things but also in the on the industry side of things. So your question specific to manufacturing is, I think that you've got a sector of the economy that is quite dynamic. It is, as you pointed out, and I'm not sure if the listeners picked up on that, it is actually one of the leading sectors here in Southern California, or putting it differently, Southern California is one of the leading manufacturing centers here in the United States.
And in the United States, manufacturing is still one of the leading GDP?
Correct. It's a high value-added segment of the economy, but it has experienced a trend decline in the number of people working in that sector over time because so much automation has taken place, which has displaced some workers. And then, of course, manufacturing on a wide, broad scale, like mass production of goods, frequently goes offshore because, they can produce at a much lower wage or lower cost of goods produced somewhere outside of the U.S. and certainly outside of Southern California.
Well, what was interesting when I read that document, it was that the number of jobs was down, the number of products produced was way up, and the earnings per worker was up.
Good point. So the people who are working in manufacturing have to be more skilled today than their predecessors had to be 10 or 20 years ago. They probably have some training in computers and other types of automation. So it's no longer that you have, say, strong hands and a strong back. You also have to have a pretty nimble mind to be able to do what's necessary in these jobs, which are increasingly automated and require some knowledge of sophisticated machinery and so on.
And that was really the first question is in the education process that we're taking people through. You might not need a college degree to understand how to operate that particular that particular piece of machinery, even though it's technical. So do we have trade types of training that are taking that on?
Yeah, I think that particular aspect of education in the United States, which is typically provided by trade schools and by community colleges, is one that is often overlooked. But I think it's very important to training people for jobs that don't require a college degree but do require something more than an unskilled background. You've got to have skilled workers. I think one of the things that we are contending with now and really have for quite some time is that we probably don't dedicate enough of our resources, our educational resources, to training people for those kinds of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much emphasis and so much pressure on seeing people complete their bachelor's, getting a college degree, which is important for the reasons I mentioned at the beginning, that it really does create someone who has a great deal of versatility. But there are a lot of other jobs, and I was just talking with one of our business assistance managers today a lot of jobs that for which you've got to have a certain set of skills. And many people who are running businesses here in Southern California right now have job openings for skilled workers, but they can't find people with the appropriate skills to fill those spots.
Exactly.
So it is a challenge right here and now, and it's an ongoing challenge, I think, for several years to come.
Well, you also have an aging workforce who, with those skills, will be retiring, and there'll even be a more of a need for those replacement skilled people with very high-paying wages.
It's true. The fact of the matter is the baby boomer generation, the oldest members of the baby boomer generation, turned 65 last year in 2011. And in terms of numbers, the first few years that are marked by that boomer generation have fairly small population numbers. But as you see people who were born in the early 1950s through the mid to late 1950s, that's where you've got the real bubble in terms of population growth in that particular generation. So I would say in the next 3 or 4 years, we're probably going to be looking at what could be a fairly large number of people going into retirement, probably not as many people choosing to retire as would have been the case before the recession.
That's right.
Right? But still, large numbers of people will at least consider retirement or maybe going to a part-time schedule, and I do think that may lead to a void in the workforce in terms of many skills, not to mention the experience that these individuals have accumulated over so many years of work.
When you do have this baby boom generation begin to retire, it brings up more pressure on the budget. So let's talk about the California budget or national budget, both of which have their share of problems. Do we solve it by aggressive cuts and austerity, or do we solve it with some type of growth program that makes sense?
So as far as the budget situation at the national level is concerned, I think it's important for us to break it into two parts. You have the budget deficit at the federal level, the $1.3 trillion deficit, and the corresponding level of national debt. The high deficits that we've seen over the last couple of years stem in part from the weakness of the economy, which has led to reduced tax revenues, and then at the same time, especially with the stimulus program that actually came and went, but the deficits, the high expenditures that were part of that stimulus program and other programs, so that has, you know, driven a wedge between the amount of money that the government was bringing in and the amount of money that it was spending. But as the economy improves, that wedge should narrow. And I think that will improve over time. So I'm less concerned about that. I'm more concerned about the Social Security program and Medicare, both of which, especially the Medicare program, that theoretically could escalate out of control and dominate the budget before too long. I guess it would be in the 2020s, by which time that might happen. But certainly changes will take place between now and then to prevent that from happening. I don't think we would sit back and just let that happen.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They had a joint committee work on those suggestions, and they produced a document, which I did read. And then it seemed like when it got to Congress, both sides went, we're not interested in those conclusions, and looked like we pushed it forward to 2013. And because of that, I think that was one of the things that pushed rating agencies to downgrade the United States credit situation. And I found that interesting because, you know, I'm connected to real estate, and my assumption would have been, okay, we have a downgrade, we have an interest rate hike, and that's not what happened.
Well, if we're talking
like a 10-year T-bill.
Right, specifically about the downgrade and what happened at the time back in August of last year, that downgrade and the anticipated impact on interest rates for T-bills and Treasury notes was trumped by what was happening in Europe, specifically the sovereign debt crisis, which was a much bigger problem. And so instead of having a spike in treasury rates as a result of the downgrade, we actually had a flight to safety globally to U.S. government securities, and that pushed yields down, not up. We are fortunate, I guess you could say, in that we continue to have the dominant and reserve currency that so many countries around the globe rely on, and we continue to be the safe haven for investors around the globe, not just around the globe, but of course here in the United States. So that worked to our advantage that time. It kept rates, actually pushed yields and pushed rates down at a time when rates otherwise might have gone up. I'm not terribly concerned about that downgrade. I do think, though, that we all have to be worried about the reaction in Washington, D.C. to problems with the deficit and the fact that they're not willing to take action that is substantive and is long-lasting. That's got to be a concern, and I'm sure that the credit markets are watching that carefully. And if we don't see, let's say, after the 2012 election, if we don't see a real concerted effort and a real plan to take care of these long-term concerns with respect to the federal budget, then I'd be more concerned about downgrades of our credit.
Well, let's say we'd get to that in 2013. Are we going to go the route of austerity? And if you have that, then how do you produce GDP growth?
Good point. The kind of austerity that or austerity programs that have been talked about and implemented in the European economies, unfortunately, they do damage to the economy in the near term, so that they can get their financial house in order. The levels of indebtedness, sovereign debt in countries like Greece and Italy relative to the overall economy are much higher than here in the United States. So if there was a belt tightening that was required in order to set things straight in the United States, it would certainly hinder a growing economy. It could slow down the pace of expansion. By the way, I mean, just for the record, it doesn't feel like we're out of the recession, but we have been expanding, and our GDP is actually higher now than it was in the last peak. So technically, the economy recovered from a recession, and it started to expand. So my point is that if we do go through an austerity program of sorts, it would either slow down that rate of growth, which is mediocre at best right now, or it could, of course, tip us back into a recession. So those are things that we have to be very concerned about going forward a year or so out.
What's interesting about what you just said, the GDP numbers have actually accelerated past the former peak, but we had 8 million jobs lost, and we've only rehired 2 million of those people.
So this is one of the quandaries we find ourselves in this particular economic cycle, and I don't think we should be surprised by it. We had the recession, and it was the Great Recession, so it was the worst recession in the working lifetimes of many of the people who are listening, and yours as well as mine.
Yes.
So a huge recession with unemployment rates that have risen to levels we hadn't seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s, both in California and in the United States. When that recession hit and when the job losses occurred, the companies became very lean with respect to their workers, their workforce. They also took advantage of technology, which, of course, has been part and parcel of the economic story really for the past 30 years, beginning with the PC and going forward. So as a result of that, they were able to pair their workforce and replace some of these functions perhaps with some type of technology. So now that the economy is coming back, some of the jobs that used to be there are no longer there because of the displacement by technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes back to the point that we were talking about earlier, that people have to be adaptable and have to be able to move into the jobs of 2012 and 2013, which might well be different from the jobs of 2002 and 2003, and training is all important for those kinds of transitions from the climate, the job climate that existed 10 years ago to the job climate we have today.
I just recently took a look at a report, and it talked about rankings as far as business-friendly states, and California really was almost at the bottom of the barrel. So you're in Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation having to attract people into an environment that you maybe didn't create. In other words, it's a negative environment. How do you trump that? How do you attract people to Los Angeles and Southern California for jobs when this reputation's in place?
So this is indeed one of the challenges that we face across all of California, and certainly down here in Southern California, with the high cost of labor relative to other parts of the country, the high cost of other resources, not the least of which would be buildings and land, and then the perception, if not the reality, that there is a fair amount of red tape that one has to navigate in order to establish a business here. Fortunately, there are entities such as the LAEDC that provide assistance to employers who are interested in locating here in Southern California to help them work through that. But it certainly is a hurdle to be overcome, that reputation that California has as not being a terribly business-friendly state. So that's something that is a long-term concern. It's been a concern, certainly, for a few decades, I would say. And it continues to be a challenge that that we have to work on.
I think Texas might be the favored state, like number one. What do they do that's so different?
Texas has, among other things, from the workforce point of view, they have no income tax
for state
at the state level,
right?
And they're also a, if I'm not mistaken, a right to work state. So the presence of unions is not quite what it is here in the state of California and other states around the country. And I do believe that their permitting and regulatory requirements are probably not what they are here in California.
You know, when you're in the predicting business, and maybe it was just me being naive, but I used to just think, okay, you just really concentrate on what's going on in California. Then I either matured or got smarter, and I said, okay, I have to really pay attention to the whole country. And now I stay up till midnight watching to see if Greece is going to default. It seems to be much more complicated than it ever has been. Is that accurate, or am I just catching up?
Well, we should all be staying up until midnight watching what's going on with Greece. There's no doubt about the fact that our local economy, the economy in your city and my city, is more closely tied, and its fate is more closely tied to what's happening around the state and around the globe than it ever has been before. To begin with, of course, you take a look at things like mortgage rates. Well, mortgage rates and rates in general are determined in the global financial system. So a problem in Greece, specifically their sovereign debt problem, can indeed cause difficulties for someone who's trying to finance the purchase of a new home or refinance a home. And so that is just one example of how we are so much more integrated today as a global economy, where local meets global in a way we didn't really have to worry about or be concerned with, let's say, 40 years ago for sure. If you go back 40 years in the early 1970s, or if you go back 50 years in the 60s, this was not terribly long after World War II had ended. The U.S. economy was really the only economy that was untouched by World War II. Its infrastructure was in place, and it was the dominant economy around the globe. Over time, it gave way as different economies, different countries rebuilt, and you then saw Germany and Japan and other economies that had been industrialized get reindustrialized and become more important players on the global scene. And then you shift forward to the 80s, and you got another wave of economies that have come on the scene.
Robert, we've ended this segment, so we'll pick up this and other topics when we get back on the next session. Thank you so much for joining.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.